This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Participants at a Labor Day rally in Portland, Maine this weekend said they hoped their city would be the next to join a handful of others who've recently bumped up their minimum wage to $15 an hour. Earlier this summer, the Portland City Council voted to put a citizens' referendum on the ballot for this November to raise the local minimum to that level. And so for the next 2 months, Portland residents will likely hear familiar arguments about the pros and cons of raising the wage, a conversation heard more often in city halls and county seats these days rather than in state capitals or in Congress. Today in The Exchange, the minimum wage debate goes local. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour joining us from D.C., Aparna Mathur. She's resident scholar in economic policy at the American Enterprise Institute. And Aparna, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, David Cooper, analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, focusing on labor markets and the minimum wage. And David, good to have you too. Thank you.
Great to be here, Laura.
And joining us also is Lydia DePillis, Washington Post reporter covering labor, business, and housing. And Lydia, welcome back. Thanks for your time.
Good morning.
Well, Lydia, to you first, how unusual is this, first of all, to have cities doing this on their own?
It's not unprecedented. Cities have done this over the past couple decades, but just really here and there. There was a Santa Fe and San Diego, I think back in the 90s. But we're starting to see a rash of them now as the president has started to make a lot of noise about the need to raise the minimum wage and how it's become increasingly obvious that it has fallen behind what it has been historically because of just simply inflation and the rise in the cost of living. It's hard to do this on a federal level because of Congress, which hasn't been able to accomplish much of anything in recent years. So cities are taking it upon themselves to do it. And there's a sort of varied legal landscape, which allows some to do it and others not. But there were a couple of leading indicators. On the West Coast, last year we had San Francisco, Seattle, and now this year, Los Angeles, deciding to raise their minimum wages to $15 over a period of some years. And that $15 number, which only a couple of years ago seemed insane, has now actually started to become reality, and that's created a momentum. Which is spreading even to cities in some conservative states. You know, down in Birmingham, Alabama, we saw recently raise its minimum wage. St. Louis and Kansas City, not to $15, but certainly much higher than they may have contemplated ever a couple of years ago.
What's the dynamic, Lydia, when a city does this? Because, you know, a city isn't an island. I mean, I'm wondering if there are repercussions both within the city and then outside the city, in terms of where people choose to live or where they choose to open up new businesses and so forth.
Absolutely. So there's a couple opposing views on this. There are some economists who say it's much better to raise minimum wages uniformly across the bigger the region, the better, essentially. And that way you don't create distortionary effects where businesses might try to locate outside, just outside the boundaries of where that minimum wage goes up. But on the other hand, cost of living tends to be higher in cities, and often there are more businesses there that can sustain higher wages. So if you look at the median wage in a particular geographical area, that might be an indicator that there will be fewer negative labor market effects on employment by raising the minimum wage just in that one area. So there's arguments pro and con doing the city approach.
So some people would say, you know, a county is better than a city, a state is better than a county, because then you don't have these sort of micro disruptions. But other people, Lydia, are saying, look, it's really expensive to live in a San Francisco or a Seattle. So sure, raise it there.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the conditions range enormously across cities as well. So San Francisco and Seattle have super hot economies where services are paying fairly well. So raising it even higher just allows people to live in or at least near the city, whereas now they're being pushed far away. That's not necessarily true of a St. Louis or a Kansas City, where you could find a lot lower cost housing. And so the argument for a super high minimum wage is not as strong.
Well, and definitely this hour, we'll get into some of the big, long-heard arguments about the minimum wage. But just focusing on this sort of local argument for a moment, Aparna, what do you make of this happening city by city?
Well, Lydia is absolutely right. I think a big reason we're seeing this happen city by city and, you know, movements, union movements across different states and cities, is that there is a lot of opposition and a lack of consensus in Congress and the federal level to push through a minimum wage increase. And I think there are very good arguments not to do it at the federal level and also not to do it at the city level either. And, you know, as an economist, I think, you know, you can make the argument that, of course, it's distortionary. You know, why should some cities do it and not others? But it's also, you know, the problem is that a minimum wage hike is likely to lead to disemployment. And whether you do that at the federal level, a federal level would essentially work as a mandate across the country and say, well, every employer now has to pay the higher minimum wage. And I think it's good to sort of steer away from that and say, you know, let's look at the cities maybe that maybe some employers can absorb it better, maybe some cities can absorb it better. But to me, you know, the essential argument against a minimum wage hike is that we know from a lot of existing research that there are likely to be disemployment effects. And whether or not we buy the research, you know, some economists will, of course, argue that, you know, there are no employment effects and everybody is better off as a result of the minimum wage hike. But we know that there are enough good economists out there also suggesting that, you know, the employment effects exist and are likely to be significant. The CBO came out with a report last year saying that if you did increase the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10, you could see about a loss of 500,000 jobs. And given the labor markets that we're seeing across the country, you know, maybe some cities are doing better than others, but given the labor market situation, given the fact that there is still so much uncertainty about jobs, so much, you know, so much of the workforce is employed in involuntary part-time work, the fact that we would try to push through a minimum wage hike to help low-income people just doesn't make sense to me. I feel like we have far better alternatives, like expanding the Earned Income Tax Credit program, which again helps low-income.
Yeah, and Aparna, I definitely want to talk to you about that. And I've read what you've written about the whole disemployment, and you feel that the minimum wage, you know,
is not the right strategy.
Yeah, it's not the right strategy. I just wonder, though, quickly, how you feel about this local trend. I mean, if some people disagree with you and say, hey, they need a bigger minimum wage, is it better to do it city by city?
I think if you believe in a minimum wage hike, then do it. There are good arguments to do it city by city. Maybe you feel that in some cities, you know, workers would not be as badly off because maybe, you know, employers are more likely to be able to absorb it. It's not clear that we would be able to make those decisions, you know, in the best way possible. So if we believe in a minimum wage hike, yeah, let's do it at the federal level. If we don't believe that a minimum wage hike is the best way to do it, then let's do the EITC expansion at the federal level. Well, so I feel like it's being pushed through at the city level because we're not getting enough consensus at the federal level, but that doesn't necessarily make it a better decision.
Well, so, David, definitely want to get you in on this. Again, what do you make of this sort of county by county or even city by city approach that we're seeing these days?
Well, I think that, as Lydia said, this is really action out of necessity, that all these cities have recognized that the minimum wage is way too low. The federal minimum wage is $7.25 today. is worth about 25% less than the federal minimum wage was worth 45 years ago. And so the fact that we're expecting people in these high-cost cities to try and get by on such low wages, it's just unrealistic. And so these cities, recognizing that, are taking action because they're not seeing their lawmakers at the federal level do it. And, you know, I think it's important to note that there really isn't any debate about this among the general public. It's all in Congress. If you poll average Americans and ask them, do they support a minimum wage increase, there's an overwhelming majority of folks that support raising the minimum wage. There was a Pew poll on the increase to 10-10. It had 70% support, including a majority of Republicans. In fact, there were four deeply red states in 2014 that passed minimum wage increases by ballot initiative. So there is a lot of support for raising the minimum wage. The fact that Congress isn't doing is sort of forcing the hand of a lot of these cities. But on the employment thing, you know, I think there is a lot of debate on this. I think Aparna is maybe overstating the case that there would be negative employment effects. And we've seen this in cities that have raised the minimum wage. Lydia noted that Santa Fe raised its minimum wage back in 2003. That was a 65% increase in the minimum wage overnight. And the New Mexico Business Association did a study of this, and they found that there was no significant effect on jobs. In fact, job growth was stronger in the city where the minimum wage went up than it was in the surrounding counties. So,
is it possible, David, that if a city goes all the way up to 15, mm-hmm. that businesses that might want to open up in that city will say, we'll just settle right outside the city lines in the suburbs instead. Too expensive.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that is a risk that we need to think about. But the fact is that most of the businesses that would be affected by an increase like this are in the retail and hospitality sector. These are the industries that pay the lowest wages. Retail businesses want to be where the customers are. So if there are people in the city spending money, they want to be close to those customers. You're not going to see the Target or the Walmart locating over the border just to avoid that lower labor cost. They're going to want to be where people have money to spend.
All right, lots more to talk about. And I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. What do you make of this city-by-city contemplation, in some cases, increasing the minimum wage? As Lydia told us earlier, San Francisco, Seattle, Los Angeles, our neighbors in Portland, Maine, are going to consider raising the minimum wage in Portland to $15 an hour this fall. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And David Cooper, Lydia DePillis, Aparna Mathur, we will be back in just a moment with more thoughts, questions, comments on the minimum wage going local. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, new angles on the familiar minimum wage debate. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or find us on Twitter. Our guests are David Cooper with the Economic Policy Institute, Lydia DePillis, Washington Post reporter covering labor, business, and housing, and Aparna Mathur, resident scholar in economic policy at the American Enterprise Institute. And Lydia, to you, David talked about the impact that we've seen so far in these cities that have raised their city minimum wages. What impact have you seen? Reduced hours or lost jobs or better standard of living? What have you seen?
It's really difficult to assess this latest wave of local minimum wage increases. There's just not comprehensive enough data. There have been a few anecdotal observations, but I feel like all of those can be countered with others, right? So, in Seattle, there was a small dip in restaurant jobs, but that could be due to all kinds of things, and it actually started bumping up again or in the most recent couple of months. And at the same time, their restaurant scene is certainly very healthy. So I think we're going to have to wait. There are going to be effects on some businesses, but at the same time, as these cities take a look at their own minimum wage proposals, they're learning from other cities. So everybody pretty much knows now that you have to phase them in so that businesses have time to adjust. It's probably a good idea to have separate schedules for smaller and larger businesses. Some are looking at targeting specific industries. So, you know, this isn't a local minimum wage increase, but it's related in New York State. They decided to raise the wage to $15 an hour just for fast food workers. And so that's another way of slicing it down. Or there's in Massachusetts, they're doing it just for home care workers. So anyway, this is evolving, and so there's learning, even though we're not, I don't think there's been rigor in enough studies on the outcomes yet.
Well, and I heard about New York and the fast food workers. It did make me wonder how you define fast food. I mean, everybody has kind of a different definition, right? I mean, certainly McDonald's is fast, but other places are sort of fast, but not quite fast.
Yeah, they've come up with a technical way of saying it. It's, you know, I couldn't cite you the exact parameters,
right.
But they do. It's based on number of establishments and type of food that they serve. And so they're, you know, you're basically targeting a certain set that you look at and say, yeah, that's fast food.
Okay, so one of the big concerns that I have heard about, and I want to ask all three of you, I'll turn to you first, I think, Aparna, is businesses either shed jobs, as you said, disemployment, but also, Aparna, let's focus on this for a moment, cutting hours. So I'm not going to fire you, but instead of, you know, 35, 40 hours a week, I can only afford to have you come in, you know, 25 hours a week. How much are you seeing that in cities or states that have raised their minimum wages, Aparna?
You know, so it's that's absolutely true. I mean, you think of it as basic economics. You're now telling the employer you used to pay somebody $7.25, and let's say when the full phase in of the minimum wage happens, you're now paying them double of what you paid before. What are the effects of that? How are employers going to react to that? Well, one way is you could, you know, just cut down on employment of these workers and maybe, you know, substitute them with machines. You actually see, you know, I was just noticing in D.C. how many stores that we used to go and have people help us check out are now automating their checkout. So, you know, that is one possible effect that you would see in the business and on these workers. A second is, yeah, you would cut hours. You would say, okay, I don't need you to, you know, to do these 5 hours in a day. Now I need you to only come in for three. And there are, you know, it's hard to say what the current wave of change is likely to bring. But as I said, you can go back to what a lot of studies show. And a recent, you know, a National Bureau of Economic Research working paper issued just in December of this year says that when you look at the effects on these low-income workers, they're largely negative. They're largely adverse. So not only are you maybe not getting the jobs and the hours at these entry-level positions that are paying the minimum wages, but you're also suffering because you're not allowed to rise up as quickly, or you don't get the promotions that you would normally get, because now the cost for the employer of not only having you at that entry-level position, but of rising up through the organization has gone up. And so it affects the mobility of these workers, it affects their employment, it affects their hours. So it just seems to me like, you know, this is not a strategy that necessarily helps all low-income workers. I agree. You know, there are many businesses that will be able to pass on these increases in cost to consumers. You know, you see maybe in Seattle, you know, prices have gone up. There's some, you know, restaurants saying, okay, don't tip us anymore. We're just going to hike up the prices. And you do see employers reacting to it, and a lot of it is anecdotal evidence. But I do expect that in the long run, you know, we will start to see these changes happen, you know, whether it's a cut in hours, whether it's a cut in employment, or it's the mobility of these workers up through the organization.
David, I do wonder about some of those impacts. And I was in D.C. in August, and I was struck by every single CVS that I went to in the city. I could barely find a live person. I had to do the self-checkout, even if I didn't want to. Is that a concern, David, that automation will replace jobs if the wages are too high, or that just hours will be cut? You know, last week you worked 30, but that's just too much, so here's 25 this week.
Right, so I'll take those in reverse order on the hours question. You know, every study that has looked at this, including the studies that do find negative effects on jobs, still conclude that the increase in income to the lowest paid workers on net is positive. So in other words, even if workers do see their hours go down, they're still making more money for the sum of the hours that they are working. So if you were to tell me I could make more money and work fewer hours, I would still be okay with that, even if my hours went down. On the automation issue, you know, this is pure scare tactics. Businesses are going to automate anyway.
This is coming no matter what.
There's always technological progress happening. You know, if we wanted to create more jobs today, we could outlaw bulldozers and just have everyone use shovels. You know, technological progress is constantly happening. The question is not, do we want to restrict that progress? It's what kind of jobs do we want for our lowest paid jobs? There's always going to be a lowest paid job. What kind of pay do we want in those jobs? Do we want it to be pay that someone can live on, or do we want it to be pay that someone has to rely on public assistance in those jobs just to make ends meet? And that's the question on the minimum wage.
All right, and here's an email that came in from Ben in Hudson, who addresses what you just said there, David. Ben says, a staggered increase could begin with larger corporations increasing wages, and then a year later, smaller companies increasing the wage. Ben says, larger companies have the most sales, so they can offset the rise in labor costs with the least increase in product cost. They also hire the most low-wage workers, Walmart, McDonald's, et cetera. Here's Ben's last point, though. He says low-wage workers who receive a raise will stimulate the economy because they spend a majority of their income more than most. And as this money enters the economy, smaller companies will be able to afford a minimum wage increase because of their increased income. This is the sort of rising tide lifts all boats argument. What do you think, Aparna?
You know, that is probably true. It is likely that for the workers who benefit, and this is also a reaction to what David just said, you know, the studies that do these employment effects or the overall income effects do divide up the analysis into, well, there will be some workers who benefit. The workers who retain their jobs are obviously going to have the higher incomes, and they're going to see, they will spend more, and that may boost the economy and may help the economy in general. But we're forgetting about the workers who actually lose their jobs. You know, nobody is arguing that everybody experiences an increase in incomes or experiences an increase in the minimum wage as a result of a minimum wage hike. There will be losers. And my only argument against that is, why should we accept such a policy where we know that there are some people who will lose out? And in a labor market where already we have, you know, millions of people sort of being sidelined who are not getting the jobs that they want. So I feel like there are better policies than, like the EITC, as I just mentioned, which don't have these employment effects. So, of course, there are some workers who benefit from minimum wage hikes, and they will spend more, and consumption will go up, and spending will go up, and the economy will get some boost. But there is this large chunk of workers who will not. And so we're always making this trade-off, and I think it's important to point that out to people who always advocate for a hike, that this is not the best policy to help all low-income workers.
Well, and Ben, thank you for the email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Should the minimum wage be raised? If so, how high? If not, why not? And also your comments on how a city-by-city minimum wage patchwork is emerging in this country. 1-800-892-6477. And let's go to our callers. Lizzie from Dover is with us. Hi, Lizzie. Go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
First, I wanted to say there is no one single solution that's going to help every single person who is low income, but I do think that the city-by-city minimum wage hike is a good idea. I mean, the idea of a minimum wage is that you can afford the minimum housing and food and transportation and everything. And right now, that's very much impossible. Anybody who says that it is has not tried to survive on the minimum wage. And to do it city by city makes sense. I mean, one of the reasons that we have local and federal control is the idea that locally we know what's going on in our area and our citizenry can respond to that and provide for our well-being.
So, Lizzie, let's talk about the city by city then. So let's say Dover raised it, but Newmarket didn't. Is there a concern that, you know, some businesses might say, you know, I was going to expand in Dover, but I think I'll go to Newmarket?
You know, I think that really sounds like scaremongering. It may happen, but I think in the long term, it's very much true. People are going to shop where they live. you know, it might happen short term, but I don't think that it's going to be a long term problem. I think in the long term, it's going to benefit more people than maybe the few that it affects negatively in the short term.
Okay. Lizzie, thank you very much for calling.
All right. Thank you.
1-800-892-6477 is the number. Again, email exchange at nhpr.org. We want your thoughts, questions, comments about the minimum wage today on The Exchange. I did want to ask you, Lydia, and maybe get David and Aparna on this as well. Our emailer, Ben, made the point that, you know, if everybody makes a little bit more money, they can spend that money in the economy, and the economy overall is boosted. Some people have made the argument as well, Lydia, that these very low-wage jobs cost taxpayers money because when people are making so very little, they need food stamps or housing assistance or Medicaid. So in a way, this is the argument, taxpayers are subsidizing businesses who pay that bare minimum. Has anybody looked at this empirically, Lydia, and said, you know, yes, that's true, or no, that's not true?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't have the studies at my fingertips, but you can track it by looking at, you know, the volume of food stamp money that goes to workers who are working in a certain place. So, you know, Walmart is one of those that has many of its workers on public assistance. And if you look at living wages, which is a calculation based on the cost of living, in many cities where a minimum wage doesn't meet that, then a certain number of folks are going to be on either food stamps or housing assistance or temporary aid to needy families. So that's a real thing. But the flip side of that is if you raise their wages, then their income threshold is going to rise above what it takes to receive those benefits. So it could actually be a net decrease in their wages, which is part of the argument for actually a super high minimum wage, because you need for it to not be a deterrent to work, right? If you're afraid of your income rising because you're going to lose benefits, then that's a problem unless you can actually earn enough to sustain yourself on your own.
Wow. Okay. So let me just make sure I got that right, Lydia. So, you know, there is an argument that some people make so little working that they need food stamps or welfare assistance. On the other hand, if the minimum wage goes up too much, they don't qualify for those anymore. So maybe that's okay because now they're making a decent wage, or is the idea that they're still, you know, living pretty skimpily?
Well, I think the idea is, I mean, most people really would like to support themselves and not take benefits from the government. But if that's impossible at the wages that retailers, for example, or restaurants are paying, then they've got to be very careful because if you don't have education, you don't have a lot of options. Now, I did want to say something, too, on the idea of income recirculation in the community when wages rise. I think that's a real thing. And I also think that one thing we might expect to see is higher minimum wages leading to decreased turnover and higher productivity from workers, which means that employers don't have to put money into hiring and retraining people who leave for whatever job might get them a little bit more money. That lowers their costs, which offsets their need to constrain hours in any way they can, which is usually limited, but sometimes possible.
Well, and David, how do you sort out the sort of, you know, welfare benefits versus minimum wage versus sort of finding that fine line where you can make enough to live on?
Right. So actually we did, the Economic Policy Institute did a study specifically on this question. And we find that, you know, workers in the bottom 20% of wage earners, so essentially anyone making less than $10 an hour, they receive at least $45 billion in government assistance each year. And that's not including the value of Medicaid. That's just the other income support programs. And so it is a fact that because these workers are earning so little on the job, the only way that they can pay their bills is to turn to public assistance. And that same study showed that if we were to raise the federal minimum wage to 10-10, which was the target at the time, the government would save about $7.6 billion each year in payments to these folks who would now be earning enough on the job. They wouldn't need to rely on such heavy assistance. And the key piece there to understand is that most of these programs phase out. So it's not like you make above some certain threshold and immediately all of your public assistance goes away. It's, you know, if you earn a dollar more on the job, maybe you get 40 cents less in benefits. So on net, you're still going to be better off. Really, the only program where there was this potential for a cliff effect where someone would immediately lose all their benefits is Medicaid. And since the Affordable Care Act expanded and built the exchanges where you get subsidies on the exchanges, that really isn't so much of a threat anymore.
All right, let's take another call. And this is Michael in Hooksett. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Welcome. How are you?
Fine.
As far as raising the minimum wage, I mean, you know, a minimum wage job working at McDonald's or bagging groceries is an intern to, you know, someone for high school. It's not a lifelong career. You raise the minimum wage at a grocery store, what's going to happen to the product prices? They're going to have to go up to compensate for those raised wages. So, you know, one hand's not washing the other with this. It's just going to, you know, create the problem further down the road, and except it's going to be creating a bigger deficit, you know, and it's just frustrating to see. It doesn't get where someone's drive to gather a higher education to make a sustainable wage, or
Michael,
I can make $15 an hour bagging groceries, and they're going to settle for that.
Michael, thank you for the call. And this is something, David, I want to ask you real quickly and then get others on it as well. The concern that Michael raises is one that is often raised with this issue, that if you increase the cost of labor, you know, everybody else will pay for it in the cost of goods and services as businesses look to recoup those costs.
Yeah, so there are a number of different ways that businesses can adjust to the higher labor costs, and Lydia actually mentioned a few of them. Number one, we see that turnover does go down when you raise the minimum wage. So businesses are spending less recruiting, hiring, and training new workers, so there's savings there. In addition, there does tend to be some productivity improvements. In other words, workers are working harder, they feel a little better about their job. So they're willing to put in a little extra effort. But if those don't add up to the increase in the labor costs, businesses can raise their prices to adjust. But the studies that have looked at this show that those increases in costs are very small. We're talking about maybe 1.5% from a 10% increase. So we're talking about the dollar menu at McDonald's becoming the $1.02 menu. It's
all
not
right,
really
David,
that
jumping
large
on you there. I do apologize, and we'll take more of your questions and comments in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the minimum wage and how cities and counties have been raising theirs independent of the federal or even state governments. You can join us with your comments and thoughts. Should the minimum wage be raised? What are some of the possible repercussions if it were, as one of our callers mentioned, possibly higher prices? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's go back to our listeners, all of you. Catherine's joining us from Lebanon. Hi, Catherine, go ahead. All right, I guess Catherine is not there. Catherine, we hope to hear back from you. Here's an email from Mike who says, to save money, McDonald's could turn their registers around to face the customers and have them order and keep kitchen workers. Small cafes, he says, have already started this in some cities. Mike says, for those fighting for minimum wage spikes, what if they were replaced by tablets? Take the lower minimum wage or eventually be replaced by technology. This is the concern that we talked about earlier. And Lydia, Aparna talked about this. What do you think in terms of, you know, David said, hey, technology is coming anyway. Otherwise, let's just get rid of tractors and I'll pick up shovels. But what do you think? Would a higher minimum wage spur more of these replacements?
So I think Dave is broadly right. I think it's true that the minimum wage increase trend is probably accelerating the process of automation. But look, I mean, these jobs eventually will probably be mechanized if they can. Like, a lot of restaurants find that people actually like to be served by an actual server or to give their order to an actual cashier. So the question is not how do we prevent that from happening, but how do we take care of these workers whose jobs might not be necessary anymore? And so I think you have to, part of the liberal argument is that a minimum wage increase can't come in isolation. It needs to be part of an overall workforce strategy to retrain people for jobs that are in demand. You know, we have a need for nurses in this country and for welders and for computer programmers. So there's a lot of things that people can do besides flip burgers, and saying that if they don't have this job, they'll have no job is pretty defeatist.
Let's go to Elizabeth in North Conway. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. My idea was that it's not just the young people flipping burgers at McDonald's. It's also the disenfranchised. It's women, middle-aged women who are maybe single mothers. It could affect. I'm totally for raising the minimum wage and doing the tax hike. You know, I mean, the greedy people should start coughing up money. I mean, you know, the poor people really suffer. I lost my job. I had 10 people saying I did a great job, and they didn't see that because, you know, it's getting to be autumn and we're in the tourist industry over here.
Sure, and, North Conway is a big tourist area. So
yeah, so it's autumn. So, like, you know, pretty soon we're going to, like, cut down the wages because the season's over. And, you know, I was making $8 an hour, and they cut me down to one day a week, you know? So
hard to make a living.
Yeah,
one day
like
a week on $8
an hour. Yeah.
Right. Well, and I don't know if it's worse than Bangladesh or not, Elizabeth, I'll set that aside. But Aparna, what do you think? People are having a hard time making ends meet. We do often hear that a lot of people making minimum wage are single moms trying to raise families. You've mentioned a couple times this hour, instead of doing the minimum wage because of the economic disruptions that you feel would happen, better use of the earned income tax credit. Can you just briefly tell us how that works and why you think that would be better?
Absolutely. I'm so glad the caller brought it up. You know, in all of this argument, it always seems to be that the only way to help people make higher incomes at the lower end is to hike the minimum wage. But we actually have a very good federal program, the Earned Income Tax Credit Program, that rewards people for working. So for every, the way it works is that for every dollar that you earn in the labor market, you have a phase-in rate of something like 30 to 40 cents on the dollar, which means that at the end of the tax year, the federal government will give you 40 cents on the dollar back for every dollar that you earn in the labor market. And there is a phase-in region, and then the maximum credit is something like $6,000, and then the benefits phase out. But the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit Program, has been hugely, you know, it's a very well-researched program, and has been hugely beneficial for single mothers especially. You know, the caller brought up that a lot of the people on the minimum wage are single mothers. And the good thing is that while you're earning the minimum wage, you also qualify for the EITC simply because you're working. And so to expand the EITC is essentially doing the same thing as a minimum wage hike, except the plus side of that is that you're not getting any disemployment effect from the EITC. The EITC has been successful at getting people into the labor market, keeping them there, hiking low incomes at the bottom, you know, helping people sort of move on in their careers. It's not just a one-time entry-level tax credit program. It actually, you can earn the, you sort of get the benefit of the EITC as you earn higher incomes all the way, I think, up to $35,000 to $40,000. And so, you know, it's one of those programs where both sides, I think Republicans and Democrats, have talked about expanding the EITC, making it, expanding it to childless adults. You know, it currently doesn't serve those people well. The size of the benefits is really low. But it's one of those programs that is, you know, just win-win. And I don't see why we're not talking about that as much as these minimum wage hikes, which seem to be so popular. But then we forget that, you know, it is likely that you would lose, some people will lose their jobs as a result of the hike.
Well, so, I think a couple quick questions for you.
Yeah,
because this is, as you say, it's not as familiar to people.
Yeah.
Perhaps, Aparna, it's just easier for people to wrap their heads around a bigger paycheck week by week than it is this sort of chunk at the end of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the big reason why it's easier to say, oh, let's have, you know, minimum wage hike, because I know that for the extra hour that I'm working, I would get, you know, more dollars. And that's clear to people. But I think a lot of people are, you know, when it comes to tax time, I mean, a lot of people claim the EITC. And so you see the benefits of the EITC at that time. Now, the problem is, of course, you get it lump, you know, in a lump sum fashion at the end of the year.
Sure.
So it's not something that you're earning weekly.
Yeah, and if you're kind of living on the edge with, you know, childcare and health care and transportation, I don't know, $6,000 at the end of the year maybe doesn't help me right now when I need, you know, money to fill up my car.
Exactly. And so I think what we would need to do is sort of make those benefits available throughout the year. So for people who are claiming the EITC at the end of the year, you know, have some means of getting that money throughout the year as a quarterly payment or as a monthly payment, even through an advance EITC, which they did experiment with before, but again, people were less aware of it. So I think there are, you know, the very good arguments for expanding the EITC. It's probably something that's not as familiar to a lot of people, but I know, you know, people claim it hugely. It's very well studied. It has no sort of obvious negative consequences on employment.
It does cost the government money, though, right, Aparna?
Yeah, it's a subsidy. It's a wage subsidy program, and so basically, what you're doing is you're supplementing incomes for people at the bottom. But it still gives people a sense of confidence and a it's not like a handout. You're working, you're getting it. The more you work, the size of the benefit goes up, and it maxes out. So I think if you look at polling and if you look at the people who are taking advantage of the EITC, you know, it's not the same as getting sort of being on public welfare or getting a cash handout. People okay. feel good about getting the EITC because it's coming through work.
Let me get your quick thoughts on that, David Cooper, and then back to our listeners. Lots of people want to jump in.
Okay, so let's just be clear. You know, I am entirely in support of increasing the EITC. It is a great program. It's very effective. I think we should expand the EITC, but we should do it in tandem with an increase in the minimum wage, because these are two policies that work well together. When you increase people's wages, they're going to get more from their EITC benefits. And the fact of the matter is, because we have failed to raise the minimum wage, the bottom 20% of wage earners in America makes less today per hour than their counterparts 45 years ago. And as a consequence of that, they're having to rely on more public dollars to supplement their income. What I'm suggesting is, let's hold businesses today to the same standard that they were held a generation ago. And if folks still need help on top of that, then we can expand the EITC and give them that help. It's not an either or. We should be talking about increasing the EITC at the same time we're raising the minimum wage, because if we don't do that, employers are actually capturing a portion of those EITC benefits. Basically, every dollar spent on the EITC, 27 cents of that is captured by the employer, because they don't have to pay higher wages that they would have had to pay otherwise. So, yes, let's expand the EITC, but at the same time, raise the minimum wage so that our labor standards reflect, you know, at least the same level of protection that we had in the 1960s.
Let's take another call. This is Steve in Portsmouth. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Yes. How are you doing, Laura? And hello to your guests. It's a very interesting issue and certainly very important during these times. I think there are a lot of sort of macroeconomic problems that lead to lower opportunity for people. But let me just take my time to go to one specific point. I think the first thing you have to revert to is the supply and demand. Currently, we have policy which is allowing sort of what I might call a full spectrum flooding of workforce visas into our country. By full spectrum, I mean everything from the agrarian service sector workers all the way up to the high-tech workers. And when you have this level of workers coming into this country, you're just going to have, just like water flows downhill, you're going to have a decrease in wages. And this is a serious, serious problem. On the high-end H-1B visas, I mean, almost two-thirds of the new hires are H-1B visas in the technology sector. Almost half the people that graduate in the STEM fields can't get a job. You look at the people who are, in the fields picking up produce, doing our service work, doing, you know, carpentry, that sort of thing. Huge numbers of immigrants, whether illegal or visa workers. So this is a serious problem, and you really have to start there, and you have to start expecting other countries to get economies at work
so,
to provide
Steve,
opportunity for these people.
Yeah, sorry to jump in on you. So concerned about immigration, but how does fit the minimum wage into this?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because this way you'd have a natural way, the prices and wages would seek a natural point which would provide opportunity for people. You wouldn't even have to talk about the minimum wage, because everyone would be making a sustainable living. That's my point. It's the flooding of the market of excess labor that creates this destitution. And then makes people cry, oh, we need minimum wage. See, the minimum wage in conjunction with open borders is a poverty engine.
I see what you're saying. So, okay. And you know, thank you for calling, Steve. Lydia, people have sort of made the connection between a low minimum wage and immigration issues. I wonder if you can tie that together for us.
Yeah. So I'm glad that he brought that up, because immigration is an interesting piece of this. So from what I'm aware, most studies show that immigration is not too much of a depressor on wages, especially on the high skilled end. When you bring in people who are able to found businesses or expand businesses, then they end up creating greater labor demand rather than less. And you also see actually some shortages in things like agricultural labor, where it's been very difficult actually to immigrate legally. And so so you're seeing wages go up in a lot of those places as farms compete to get workers who know how to do this stuff. So I don't think that's a huge part of what is depressing wages. Now, certainly supply and demand is a thing. And over the past like few months, we've seen anecdotal evidence of what's called labor market tightening, where companies like McDonald's and Walmart have had to boost their minimums a little bit to try to keep people from going to do drive for Uber or, you know, be a home care worker. So so that is a thing that happens when the economy recovers. Now, what I think these cities are deciding is that it's not enough and it's not keeping up with the cost of living, and that there needs to be some government intervention to try to boost it.
Well, Steve, thank you for the call. Let's go to Berlin, where Bruce is on the air. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange.
Yeah, hi. I had a couple of quick points. First was to your example about Dover raising the minimum wage and the business owner just opening a new market. That new market business owner is still going to have to hire quality employees. And if those employees know that they can get twice the money by driving 10 minutes away into Dover, the new market business owner is going to have to either raise the wages he's offering or not be able to recruit quality employees. So I think it would have a ripple effect. Labor markets don't tend to start and stop at city lines. So it would have a ripple effect in the larger labor area. That's my first point. And my second point is I am one of those people, although I don't make minimum wage, I am one of those people who now is looking at trying to increase my income and losing benefits. It's an enormous consideration. I am self-employed. My income went down last year, and I was able to qualify for better health insurance for my kids, a little bit better deal for my son in college. You know, there were several different things. And now I'm looking at if I get a $5,000 or $10,000 a year income increase, it's actually going to cost me $13,000 or $14,000 in other benefits. And it's not just food stamps. It's college tuition. It's
sure.
Benefits.
Wow. So, Bruce, can I ask you a question? So
yep.
It's interesting what you say. So does this make you the fact that if you increase your income a little bit, you will end up paying more for health insurance and you won't get as much perhaps in financial aid for college? So how does this make you feel about the minimum wage?
Well, I think the same. It just supports the point that was made earlier, that if you raise the minimum wage by $2 or $3, it's $10 an hour. That's going to put a lot of people in a situation where while they make more money, they'll actually have a lower ability to survive because of the benefits. If they lose $4 an hour in benefits but only gain $3 an hour in wages, that's going to put a lot of people in worse shape.
So should we not raise it?
I think we should raise it, but we should raise it sufficiently to allow people to get off of public assistance altogether. And I have the same attitude with the earned income credit. That's just another federal government subsidy to subsidize people who can't earn a living. And I think if you work 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week or whatever it is, you should be able to support a family of 2 or 3 or 4 people.
Okay.
And right now you can't with 2 people working full time.
Bruce, I got to wrap you up there, and I do apologize. So, Lydia, real quick, just to finish with you, it's kind of trying to find that sweet spot. Sounds like that's what he's saying, where, you know, people can make a living but not lose some of those benefits.
Yeah, and that's been an interesting part of the politics of this, because for a while there, we were seeing these proposals of like pretty incremental increases. Like the president's proposal of 10-10 an hour seemed ambitious, but then this whole fight for 15 thing started, and that was 15. But people could really fight for 15 in a way that they're not going to fight for 10-10. So that's changed this calculus very rapidly.
All right. Well, lots more to talk about, but we'll wrap it up there. Lydia DePillis, thank you very much for giving us your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Lydia DePillis, Washington Post reporter covering labor, business, and housing. Aparna Mathur, it was great to have you. Thank you also for your time.
Thank you so much. It was great being here.
Aparna Mathur, resident scholar in economic policy at the American Enterprise Institute, and David Cooper, thank you also for being with
us. Thank you, Laura.
David Cooper, analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, focusing on labor markets and the minimum wage. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer this week is David Darman. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.